From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Here's an old movie that's no doubt flying off video rental shelves.
The money's the key to whatever this is.
Says who?
Deep Throat.
Who?
Oh, that's Woodward's Garage Freak, his source in the executive.
Garage Freak? Jesus, what kind of a crazy story is this?
What kind of crazy story? The kind that slowly, incrementally grips the world and ultimately topples a presidency. The kind that fills history books and bestsellers, that goes Pulitzer and Hollywood. The kind that inspires a generation of journalists to shine the bright light of inquiry into the darkest corners of government. The kind of mythic tale that permanently enshrines itself in the psyche of a nation. At the heart of that myth, the garage freak known as Deep Throat. The identity of Woodward and Bernstein's source was Watergate's last secret. Until this week, we witnessed the unmasking, under ambiguous circumstances, of the former FBI official named Mark Felt. On the Don Imus Show, Bob Woodward tried to explain why Deep Throat remained under deep cover for 31 years.
This is a man who was in turmoil, not sure whether he did the right thing or the wrong thing, and saw the Watergate cover-up and chose the route to talk to me.
Motivation. That was the central theme of the week's media free-for-all. Why did the number two man in the FBI risk career and prosecution to speak to Woodward? Why did he remain silent for so long? Why, at the age of 91, addled by dementia and stroke, did he finally come forward? Why didn't he let the Washington Post close the circle? And why, of all venues, opt for the celebrity-obsessed Vanity Fair? Maybe because of vanity, and maybe because it's only fair. Watergate and the Deep Throat guessing game itself had grown into an industry, generating revenue for damn near everyone but Mark Felt. Here's Woodward on Larry King Live talking about his pending Deep Throat memoir.
You have a publisher, you have a deal already.
Well, we can get a deal, that's for sure. And
profitability was probably the week's least intriguing question. But Deep Throat can hardly fault anyone for the journalistic impulse to follow the money. What was hilarious was seeing who did.
It really goes against my grain to have Mark Felt coming over as a great American hero, and that's why his family put it out. They also said they'd like to make a little money out of it.
That, of course, was Bob Novak, who makes a living converting Washington leaks into TV blather and syndicated columns, such as one originating in the Bush administration outing CIA officer Valerie Plame. That wasn't the only slice of irony served up this week. TV news was more or less hypocrisy central, featuring lessons on ethical behavior from convicted Watergate conspirators Charles Colson and G. Gordon Liddy.
He was a very, very highly placed law enforcement official, number two at the FBI. If such an official gains knowledge and evidence of a crime having been committed, what he is ethically bound to do is to go to a grand jury and get an indictment, not selectively leak some information to one source.
That was Liddy on NBC Nightly News. Here's Chuck Colson on Nightline.
If he was concerned about what was happening in the White House, I think his obligation was to go to the director of the FBI, his boss, and then immediately walk in and see the President of the United States and tell him.
A thunderously naive notion, especially if you buy media portrayals of Mark Felt as an embittered soul, passed over for the FBI directorship and infuriated by Nixon administration interference in the Bureau's investigations. Maybe he was motivated by truth and justice, and maybe he was just another disaffected bureaucrat with an axe to grind. In one of the week's more telling observations, Woodward said he didn't much care about Deep Throat's motivations, so long as the information checked out. Which, of course, it did. The idea is so basic, yet at this moment in journalistic history, it screams with significance. The use and abuse of anonymous sourcing has lately been the stuff of scandal. It remains unclear whether any Koran pages were flushed down the toilet at Guantanamo, but a measure of media credibility surely was, because, in the words of Newsweek's Michael Isikoff, he dropped the ball. So indiscriminate is the practice of not naming names that Jason Blair, Jack Kelly, and Stephen Glass invented sources and their editors didn't even notice. Unnamed law enforcement sources exploited such carelessness to sweat nuclear scientist Wen-Ho Lee and hero-turned-Olympic bombing suspect Richard Jewell before both were cleared of wrongdoing. Because the reporters of those stories, unlike the pavement-pounding Woodward and Bernstein, were satisfied with their various shallow throats. And in that, the final irony. Many of this generation's journalists are journalists because of Woodward and Bernstein, whose exploits inspired them, or shall I say, motivated them, to seek their own explosive scoops of the Watergate variety. Unfortunately, like little leaguers inspired by Willie Mays' virtuosic basket catches, the wannabes too often dropped the ball. The unquenchable desire for the explosive actually calls to mind another movie scene, this one, in fact, from the real Deep Throat.
I want to hear bells and bombs.
Yes, we just went through that, Miss Lovelace. Have you ever had an internal examination?
If it weren't obvious before this week, for the news media, it certainly is now. An internal examination? What a splendid idea.
Since All the President's Men hit bookshelves in 1974, Deep Throat code breakers have been using the clues that Woodward and Bernstein peppered throughout their book to concoct their theories on Deep Throat's identity. William Gaines and his students at the University of Illinois used the available clues to try and crack the mystery. We spoke to Gaines in 2003.
I saw a list of the 10 greatest mysteries of the 20th century, and Deep Throat was number 5. Amelia Earhart was number 1. And it struck me at the time that nobody knows what happened to Amelia Earhart, but somebody knows who Deep Throat is, and they're not telling us. So I guess that became a challenge. And also added to that challenge was a statement that Ben Bradley, you know, the editor of Woodward and Bernstein at the time, made recently, that somebody could probably take all the information known about Deep Throat and put it in some huge computer, and they'd be able to figure out who Deep Throat was.
Gaines and his students figured out that Deep Throat had to be Fred Fielding. They were apparently wrong. But who can blame them? It turns out the clues that were supposed to lead us there were misleading us all along. Tim Noah, a longtime Deep Throat sleuth who writes the Chatterbox column for Slate, complained this week, and he joins me now. Tim, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you, Brooke.
Let's first give credit where credit is due. Despite the misdirections, you and others have been saying Mark Felt for a while. James Mann, Nora Ephron, Richard Nixon, Washingtonian Magazine. How did you first land on Mark Felt for sure?
I should confess before I proceed that in recent years I had started to wonder if it was Fred Fielding. But yes, the person I've stuck with most was Mark Felt. And the evidence seemed pretty compelling. It was laid out in a magazine article by James Mann in 1992 that Deep Throat had to be someone at the FBI. And one of his reasons for believing this was that during the period immediately before and during the Watergate stories, Mann worked at the Washington Post and sat next to one Bob Woodward, who was always shooting his mouth off about his hot FBI source.
But what are the clues that could have sent you off the trail to identifying Mark Felt?
Well, there were principally two. One is that Deep Throat is described as a smoker. But Felt was not a smoker. He had quit smoking in the 1940s. So one of two things has to be true. Either Woodward and Bernstein included the smoking detail as misdirection, or Felt has a second secret, which is that he's been sneaking cigarettes.
And that certainly sent William Gaines off on the wrong track.
That's right. Well, it's like the data processing line, garbage in, garbage out.
Now, you said there were two bits of garbage that threw you off. First, the smoking. The second, where Deep Throat worked, or where Woodward said he didn't work. You believed him when he said in a 1979 Playboy interview that Deep Throat didn't work in an intelligence agency.
That's right. There was a Playboy interview, and Anthony Lucas, a very accomplished late journalist, asked Woodward if Deep Throat was a member of the intelligence community. And Woodward, in so many words, said no. Now, he was a member of the intelligence community. I've gotten some letters from people saying that the FBI is not an intelligence agency, it's a crime-fighting agency. And I had talked myself into that for a while, but then I thought about the historical context And this was a period immediately after a spell when the FBI was spying on seemingly everybody. And people thought of it at the time as these revelations were coming out in the late 70s in the wake of J. Edgar Hoover's death. Clearly, the FBI was part of the intelligence community. And Woodward writes about it as such in the long narrative that was in the Washington Post on Thursday.
Well, Tim, is a little misdirection to protect a source so very bad?
I think journalists have an obligation always to be truthful, even about the most trivial things. Journalists swarm over government officials when they are untruthful, even about trivial things, and it would be a double standard to do otherwise. And besides, as a reader, I want to read something that's truthful. I want to know when I'm reading an article in the Washington Post that every word in it is true to the best of the ability of the reporter who wrote it.
We as journalists always say that reporters should never reveal their sources because it will discourage other potential leakers and whistleblowers from coming forth. Well, here Woodward took that extra step of obscuring his identity by saying he didn't work for intelligence, that he was a smoker. Wouldn't that build the confidence of would-be leakers knowing that their identity would be so very obscured?
When leakers ask for that kind of protection, they're asking for too much. We can ask that you disguise his identity through misdirection, but I don't think journalists should grant that wish.
But would you have believed Hal Holbrook as much if he wasn't puffing in that garage?
You know, I got an interesting email yesterday from someone who said, you know, Hal Holbrook, all wrong for Mark Felt. You want Christopher Walken. He's got the hair.
Thanks very much, Tim.
Thanks, Brooke.
Tim Noah writes the Chatterbox column for Slate.
It involves the entire U.S. intelligence community, FBI, CIA, Justice. Get out your notebook. There's more. Your lives are in danger.
Coming up, how to program for a continent and how not to.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. All over America this week, TV news delivered the latest on Deep Throat, Iraq, and of course, Michael Jackson. Or rather, all over the Americas, North, Central, and South. But not everybody from Buenos Aires to Caracas is as thrilled as we are with news from the North. And they're even less thrilled when their news is presented through the prism of U.S.-friendly media conglomerates. And so last week, a group of journalists in Venezuela piloted a continent-wide network that will launch officially next month, its name Telesur, its mission to deliver Latin American news from a Latin American perspective.
General Director Aram Aronian told a Mexican newspaper that the project was, quote, born from the conviction that we can't leave television, the most powerful medium out there today, in the hands of the enemy. That enemy, he suggests, is free market neoliberalism. And Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who 3 years ago survived a coup attempt actively abetted by wealthy TV owners, shares that belief. In fact, it was Chavez who spearheaded Telesur, appointing his information minister network president and supplying 70% of its seed money from his country's oil-rich coffers. Argentina and Uruguay are covering the rest, with technical assistance from Brazil. But despite all the government backing, Telesur's founders say it will be editorially independent. Nicholas Kozlov, senior research fellow with the left-leaning Council on Hemispheric Affairs, says the Pan-Latin network is a product of its time. throughout South America, we've seen the rise of center-left regimes that share many commonalities with Hugo Chavez's politics. So I think that that's made possible for the first time, maybe hemispheric initiatives like this.
Telesur has been compared quite a bit to Al Jazeera. They have in common funding by a government. In the case of Al Jazeera, the government of Qatar. And, of course, Al Jazeera is a pan-Arab channel crossing borders. Do you think it's a good comparison?
In terms of the state sponsorship, there are parallels. In terms of the politics as well, I would say there are some commonalities. Al Jazeera has been a thorn in the side of the Bush administration in the Middle East. Similarly, I think that Bush can't be very pleased about the rise of Telesur, which is designed to counter what is widely seen as pro-American media in the hemisphere, such as Univision, CNN in Spanish, and other networks.
Al Jazeera has also been a thorn in the side to a lot of governments throughout the Middle East. If Telesur is truly independent, can you see it becoming a kind of Frankenstein's monster that turns on its own creators?
It is possible that perhaps Telesur might become a thorn in the side of center-left regimes throughout South America. The director of Telesur, whose name is Aram Aharonian, though Aharonian has supported many of the social programs promoted by Hugo Chavez, he's also expressed reservations about Chavez in some of his reports. So the claim that maybe the reporters at the news station are overly partial to Hugo Chavez, I'm not sure that's actually true, and we'll have to see how that pans out.
Well, let's look at that possibility, though, because there are concerns that Telesur will, in effect, become a propaganda blunt instrument for Chavez and for the other center-left regimes throughout Latin America. There are, of course, other government-funded broadcasters around the world, including the BBC, and at least through one degree of separation, NPR. What mechanisms are in place to make sure that there is some degree of independence from the funders?
I don't know about the specific mechanisms. I think that the issue of state sponsorship of the media raises concerns. However, the fact that the BBC, for example, gets state money does not necessarily mean that reporters there are compromised ethically. And I've seen some interesting interviews with Aram Aharonian basically posing the question of, well, why don't you pose this question to people in the corporate media? You never ask them if they're compromised because they're employed by a corporate media station. And I think it's a well-taken point.
You know, the funders of this, Venezuela, Argentina, and Uruguay, are all part of a new center-left movement that you've described, but they're not a monolithic force. Do you think it's inevitable that squabbling will quickly ensue?
I wouldn't overplay that possibility. The question for me is not so much whether Telesur is going to be derailed by conflicting politics. The commercial viability is another matter, because state media throughout South America has historically not achieved very high ratings, and it's been associated with propaganda machine, and so they're going to have to overcome that legacy. I think that maybe Telesur's viability will be decided in Argentina, which is a market of 40 million as opposed to 25 million in Venezuela. And the Argentines are already very accustomed to their own local TV news stations. So I think they really have their work cut out for them.
So not to put any ironies in your mouth or anything, but has it struck you that the success of the anti-free market agenda of Telesur could hinge on the free market?
I think many people are fed up with the established media in these countries. If Telesur is able to capitalize on that political discontent and the whole revulsion of the economic agenda pushed by Washington and the free trade agreement of the Americas, the International Monetary Fund, then they'll be able to succeed. But you can show the other side of South America through South American eyes, but if it's not lively, it won't really matter in the end result.
And in the meantime, though, the revulsion will be televised. Nicholas, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Nicholas Kozloff is a senior research fellow at the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
5 years ago, a group of private investors saw in another part of the developing world a ripe prospect for transnational television. Africa. And with the help of the International Finance Corporation, the private investment arm of the World Bank, they formed TV Africa. Like Telesur, it featured programming from all over the continent, beamed to local affiliates for over-the-air broadcast. Aimed at poorer people who had no access to satellite dishes, it couldn't fail. But a mere 3 years later, the plug was pulled on TV Africa. Darren Massara is a senior investment officer for the International Finance Corporation, one of the prime movers behind the project. He says there was every reason to believe that the Pan-African Network would succeed, considering all the people who stood to benefit.
First was African viewers. We wanted to provide them with free, high-quality entertainment and education-based programming. And this is programming that they otherwise would only be able to view through a subscription-based service such as satellite TV. Secondly, regional and multinational advertisers. We wanted to provide them with a one-stop shop to reach an addressable market of, at the time, around 110 million potential viewers. And finally, the local affiliates, we wanted to provide them with the ability to attract additional viewers and sell more local advertising around this improved programming lineup.
What was the programming, though, and where did it come from?
The programming was general entertainment combined with sports, you know, dramas, miniseries, as well as a little bit of current affairs and news, and with a large chunk of education programming, about 5 hours a day of curriculum-based education. And that programming primarily came from within Africa. We tried to commission programming in individual countries with the hope that, for example, a Nigerian drama would travel very well throughout the rest of the continent.
It seems like you had a solid business plan, a good idea, a ready market. What the heck went wrong?
Well, I think there are three main reasons why it failed. First was I think we overestimated the market growth. There was a sense that TV Africa would be such an appealing proposition that it would actually drive the advertising market itself, and that turned out not to be the case. The second main reason is on the content side. When we tried to adjust to national and cultural norms, it was difficult for the content to appeal to the masses everywhere. And finally, when TV Africa was able to sell advertising around its programming, it had difficulty collecting the revenue that it earned because affiliates often did not air TV Africa programming when it was designed to. So the advertising ultimately was not viewed. And it wasn't just us that ran into this problem. There was another company who was our main competitor in the Pan-African broadcast space, had a different business model, but had the same concept. And they also failed right around the same time that TV Africa failed as well.
Darren, what did you take away from this experience with TV Africa?
I think the main takeaway is that media really is local. You know, unlike the mobile network or unlike other types of manufacturing companies, you know, media tends to develop locally. And, you know, to the extent you want to extend across country boundaries or regional boundaries, it's going to be very challenging.
And so what did Al Jazeera then get right?
I think in a way you need something that appeals to people in one particular way, you know, trying to, in a way, unite a group, much in the way that I think the new Pan-Latin American government-supported initiative does, is really trying to unite people in a way that hasn't been done before. You know, ultimately, I think that it is difficult to appeal on a mass basis to individuals across country lines. I think if you're focused a little bit more in a niche product or a niche segment such as Pan-African news, Pan-African sports, or even children's channel, something very specific, I think, works much better than a general entertainment to try to reach all of the population all of the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Darren Massara is Senior Investment Officer for the International Finance Corporation, a member of the World Bank Group in Washington.
Judging by the story of TV Africa, creating a 24-hour lineup for a transnational audience is a Herculean task. Or is it? There is, after all, one region of the world where transnational television has proved not only viable but hugely influential. I'm talking, of course, about the Middle East, where satellite technology cleared the path for Pan-Arab TV and transformed the region's historically repressed and parochial media landscape. The most prominent channel, Al Jazeera, has even shed the stigma of its state sponsorship, and other channels, most notably that of the Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation, have shown that despite the experience of TV Africa, entertainment programs can cross national borders.
American University Assistant Professor Marwan Krady is a scholar of Arab media, one among many writing about the impact of pan-Arab satellite channels on Mideast political life. But it's not the explicitly political programming that he's interested in. It's the entertainment programming, where the impact is inversely proportional to its cost. So cheap, so much bang for the buck. Case in point, an unprecedented regional hit produced by the Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation called Star Academy.
Perhaps the best way to describe it would be Big Brother meets American Idol. You have 8 men and 8 women living together for 4 months in a 4-story building, completely isolated from the outside world. They spend their week taking lessons in dance, singing, oral interpretation, even cooking, fashion, aerobics, very much a school for the performing arts. And then on Friday evening, they put together a show. And at the end, one of the contestants is voted out by audience members. Now, what's very interesting about the show is that LBC devoted a satellite channel to the show. So at any time of the day or the night, you could check in and see what's going on. There were about 60 cameras in the building. Every corner was covered except the bathrooms. So it's truly an unprecedented media event in the region.
It was enormously popular. It captured more than 50% of the pan-Arab audience from Morocco to Saudi Arabia across all demographics.
You know, audience data in the Arab world is notoriously difficult to come by, at least the reliable sort. But we know for a fact that in Lebanon, which is the only country that has people meters in the households, in other words, where we can know for a fact what channel is on at a given time, we know that the audience was 80% in the age bracket of the 18 to 35. From my own research, it seems to be that it was across social economic groups, both men and women, both Christians and Muslims in Lebanon. It was very, very popular.
How do you account for the success?
You know, for youth groups, there was a sense that this was something very special, mainly because people could participate in it. If the audience does not call and vote, then the show cannot go on. There was a sense that the program seems to provide young people the picture of a meritocracy, which contrasted to their daily lives. A lot of the people I spoke with were having problems finding jobs because they didn't have connections, were having problems paying for college tuition, and obviously the idea of political participation was something that was very much on people's minds.
When you talk about participatory democracy in this program, did it seem like a kind of model?
A lot of columnists suggested this. In other words, if people get used to choosing contestants, that is quite equivalent to voting for politicians. But I think what we really need to look at is how fans of different contestants organized. They set up websites, they set up all kinds of chains using mobile phones to mobilize each other and mobilize others to vote for one contestant as opposed to the other. Now, we saw also that these informal networks of people who are joined by a common interest can be converted for use in a political arena. We saw that happening to some extent after the assassination of former Prime Minister Hariri in Lebanon, whereby groups of young people used mobile phones to organize. And even I have pictures of some demonstrators in downtown Beirut who used the language of Star Academy to make their point. The most representative, perhaps, is a young man carrying a poster. In the middle, there's a picture of Emil Lahoud, the current president of Lebanon, whose mandate was extended last year with Syrian support. On top of the picture, it says nominee. In other words, this is a nominee to be voted out, like in the show. And under the picture, it says call 1559. 1559, if you recall, is the number of the UN resolution calling for the withdrawal of Syrian troops from Lebanon. Usually on the show, you get a 4-digit number that audience members can call to vote a candidate out. So people understood that language because the program was so popular.
The show has generated its share of controversy. I mean, it did cause a dust-up in, say, Saudi Arabia, didn't it?
In Saudi Arabia, the way the show was received was incredible. A very official committee of clerics issued a very long fatwa, the first fatwa completely dedicated to one television show. The gravest problem with the show, in their opinion, was the issue of ikhtilat, which is gender mixing, which is men and women living together, talking together. But look, if the controversy did one thing, it was to boost the popularity of the show in Saudi Arabia. Also, there are competing business interests throughout the region that tend to become a countervailing force to the more conservative clerics. And so we see that economic interests are clashing with religious interests, and in this case, economic interest seems to have won.
You know, it's funny, in this country, when you have these sorts of media controversies, they have a way of devolving into sometimes pretty infantile debates. But in the case of Star Academy, you say that something very different happened.
Yes, in many ways, Star Academy became code word for debating, you know, male-to-female relations in the Arab world, for debating Western Arab relations, human rights, the role of popular culture in society, and perhaps more importantly, the role of religious leaders in society. So that if you're reading a column in one of the big pan-Arab dailies, you'll see somebody writing about the opposition in Egypt, and suddenly they throw the example of Star Academy in to illustrate one point or the other. There'll be a talk show on Al Jazeera or on Al Arabiya, and Star Academy again serves as an example to illustrate some of the issues that I just mentioned. These discussions had been going on, but at a much lower decibel level. You know, one of the things that these programs do is they provide a common platform. They bring people together. And by doing that, we know that, for instance, people in Morocco are more aware of Lebanon, of Iraq, of Saudi Arabia than they were in 1992 when the satellite industry was not what it is today.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Marwan Krady studies Arab media and teaches at the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C.
Coming up, the age of open source media is upon us. Why it pays to give it away.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This show often reports on the ongoing argument over intellectual property rights. On one side, the media industries that spend billions making television, film, and music products. On the other, the ordinary people who sit before flickering screens, slicing and dicing those products for their own amusement, and sharing them in podcasts and blogs and encrypted networks, an arena collectively called the Dark Net. Here's an example of what you can hear there, a mashup of presidential speeches with the song Sympathy for the Devil.
That's news to me.
In today's world, direct communication is a ticket to success. So tonight I propose that I had to destroy you once and for all. In the next 4 years, I will work with my fellow Americans,
take a request
with the ultimate goal, the total control of your soul. We're the real art. Next, please stand up.
To the denizens of the darknet, it's artistic license. To the media industry, it's theft, and it must be stopped. But as we'll hear in the rest of this segment, placing digital locks on intellectual property may only breed better lockpickers and the ill will of consumers.
We begin with J.D. Lasica, author of the new book Darknet, Hollywood's War Against the Digital Generation. Lasica says the Darknet harbors two kinds of people, the creative and the criminal.
Some people just don't want to pay, you know, $10 to see the latest Hollywood movie. I think that's wrong. But other people want to take advantage of these kinds of works and remix them and weave them into their own works and make a new statement. So these are the kinds of creative works that are technically illegal, and we're going to see what happens when this kind of collision between traditional media forms and these new emerging media forms come into play.
This does seem like the classic example of an immovable object and an irresistible force. Technology and the creative spirit and the desire to remix the president's speeches to the Rolling Stones being the irresistible force, and ownership rights, based on the blood, sweat, tears, ingenuity, and capital of the owners, the immovable object. The collision, as you said, is in progress. At the moment, what's happening?
Traditional media needs to become aware of what's happening out there and to, you know, loosen up a little. Don't be afraid of losing control over what you're calling your intellectual property. Let it go out there and capture new audiences. This example that we're just talking about here was Sympathy for the Devil, and probably today's kids in high school and college probably never heard of it. So here the Rolling Stones are finding new audiences for that kind of music. But what I wanted to emphasize is that the technology is outpacing the law. It's outpacing what kind of conversations are happening in Congress today, where actually there's an impulse to sort of crack down on this kind of behavior rather than to enable it or to celebrate it. One of the episodes in the book was that I actually wrote to all seven major Hollywood studios asking for permission to use little snippets of their movies in a new home movie that I wanted to make with my five-year-old son. So like 15 seconds of Ice Age or 30 seconds of Mary Poppins. And six out of the seven studios flatly said no.
There's a story in your book about an amazing fellow who reshot the entirety of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Tell me that story.
Well, there were three kids who were about 12 years old when this whole thing began. They saw Raiders of the Lost Ark on the big screen, and they basically said to themselves, this is so totally cool. I want to do this, too. So they began a little project filming a remake of Raiders of the Lost Ark in their backyards. And it basically took them about 7 years to finish. And at the end of it, they had a little screening in their hometown. Everybody came out to see it. Wild applause.
They recreated it shot for shot, costume for costume, special effect by special effect, no?
Right. You know, they got some garden snakes in the backyard. They had a dog sub in for a monkey, that sort of thing. But other than that, it was a very faithful recreation of the entire something like 80-minute work. They basically pulled it off, and people who've seen this were kind of blown away by the whole thing. So the trouble is that they never got the rights to show this, other than in their living rooms, to anybody outside of their immediate family. So under the law, under copyright law, it's a derivative work, which means that you need the permission of the copyright holder, which, you know, no studio is about to give. So nobody's going to be able to see this movie ever until the copyright on Raiders expires in about 100 years from now. You know, I don't think anybody would argue that this kind of fan filmdom is hurting anybody, but it just shows that the laws are out of step with what people are doing with their works.
Is there any reason to think that the United States Congress understands the issues as you've presented them, or do you think they're just going to listen to an aggrieved Hollywood and give Disney et al. All of the further protection that they request?
It's been a one-sided conversation up until now, so that the movie companies, the music labels, they've got their folks up on Capitol Hill repeating over and over and over the word stealing and piracy. So there has to be some nuance brought into the conversation. There has to be some sort of understanding that if some of these innovative new technologies that are coming down the line as far as file sharing and BitTorrent, if these kinds of things are outlawed, that'll just drive people further into the dark net, into the underground, make more people into lawbreakers, and ultimately it's going to harm the culture.
J.D., thanks very much.
Good to be here. Thanks a lot.
J.D. Lasica is author of Darknet, Hollywood's War Against the Digital Generation.
At any given time, the BBC's website is the most visited news site in the world, fed by content from BBC broadcasts, funded by license fees paid by British citizens when they buy TVs. The site is the prime access point for anyone who can't tune in. So it was quite a surprise when the BBC announced last month that it would relinquish some control of its online content, and by extension its brand, in order to capture some of the kinetic energy of internet innovation. Backstage.bbc.co.uk is the gateway to BBC Online's raw material, now available for almost any legal and non-commercial use. The only requirement is that potential users explain what their intentions are. Tom Loosemore is the co-creator of Backstage BBC, and he joins us from London. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Did this spring fully form from your imagination, or was it a reaction to something else?
Frankly, it was a combination of two things we'd noticed. One was that a particular group amongst our audience of real amateur innovators were, regardless of whether we'd given them permission or not, finding new ways to reuse BBC content and had frankly come up with some very interesting ideas. And secondly, we'd seen from the States, in fact, the likes of Google and Yahoo and Amazon had really gone forth and developed a relationship with the same community via their developer networks and had had a great deal of success with that.
Give me some examples, please, of the kind of material that was showing up on the web that was using as its basis BBC material.
There's a very good example of a guy who had taken a copy, a live copy of our news site, for example, and had, within the body of the actual story, where there was a phrase, say, Kofi Annan or the United Nations, he had automatically turned that phrase into a link that went to the definition within the Wikipedia encyclopedia. Wikipedia is a well-known online encyclopedia. So if you were reading a story and it mentioned something you knew nothing about, you could then go and get the background and get up to speed and therefore understand the story better. It's a great idea, completely against our terms and conditions previously.
Now, if you were operating in the United States, the logical next step would be to unleash a phalanx of lawyers on the people at Wikipedia or at Wikiproxy, this website, and the litigation would flow. But that's not the path you took. Why?
We are, remember, funded very differently from commercial companies. We are single-mindedly focused on delivering public value to everyone in the UK rather than shareholder value to our shareholders. And therefore, I think it does make it easier for us to let go. Having said that, I think you can see from the likes of Google and Yahoo, which are not charities, that they see great benefits from following a similarly open approach. For example, Google allows access to the insides almost of its search engine to people who want to innovate in a non-commercial way because they want to see where the innovation is going, they want to encourage it, they want to keep close to that community. It's a vital community to them. And so I think, you know, yes, it's easier for the BBC to do it. And while we definitely had concerns, we got the guy in, we wanted to understand why he'd done what he'd done, and I think we were able to have a constructive dialogue rather than a dialogue of the deaf.
Tell me about your internal dialogues at the BBC before you decided to surrender at least some control of your content to outsiders who have no responsibility to you or, strictly speaking, to your audience.
Bear in mind, we really are only relinquishing a little control of where headlines and links to our own stories appear on the web. And it was a constructive dialogue about the balance of risk and reward. I mean, the BBC is, again, because of the way we're funded, we have to make sure everybody in the UK can get value from the money they pay. It's almost irrelevant how people come to find us. And this was seen as a good step to get more people to come and consume our content.
What have been the immediate benefits of both the unauthorized linking to BBC material and BBC Backstage itself?
Backstage itself has astonished me in the 2 weeks it's been live with the quality and, frankly, the volume of ideas that have sprung forth. I mean, we were the most linked to website in the blogosphere for much of last week. A community of sort of 600 or so developers has emerged out of nowhere and are throwing ideas and products, indeed, that they've made at each other. For example, they're mixing our content with maps. They're turning our text content into audio content automatically. There's a whole range of ideas that, if we'd have been lucky in the BBC, we may have come up with ourselves.
But what's the downside? For example, if I decide at my porn site, and it's a good one, to start using BBC material in some salacious manner, what are you prepared to do about that?
We don't just give our stuff away willy-nilly. I mean, we do ask people to accept terms and conditions written by lawyers. And in amongst that is a condition that you don't associate BBC content with materials that would denigrate our brand. And so if we did see content appearing on a porn site, we'd ask you to remove it for having broken our terms and conditions.
So what's the single coolest thing you've seen so far that surprised and delighted you?
I think the single coolest thing was some guy who had taken all of our news headlines, so live news headlines, and automatically turned them from text into audio using a text-to-speak conversion. I mean, he's let people podcast BBC News headlines onto their iPods or onto their MP3 players. Now, it's spoken in a voice that sounds like a robot, but for me, I would never imagine it in 1,000 years that someone could or would do that.
That's been said of BBC presenters since time immemorial, actually, that they're a bit robotic. Is this some sort of joke that there's afoot here?
I can assure you our presenters are working very hard to speak in a way that doesn't alienate them. But I think if we converted them into robots, people would notice pretty quickly nowadays.
Well, Tom, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tom Loosemore is the co-creator of backstage.bbc.co.uk.
The BBC may have opened its doors to internet innovators, but the U.S. radio giant Infinity Broadcasting has let them take over the store, or at least one money-losing AM station in San Francisco. Renamed KYOU, its programming consists entirely of podcasts, downloadable, often do-it-yourself radio shows solicited and selected by the KYOU staff. Though the station is advertiser-supported, these podcasters/broadcasters aren't paid in cash, but with the opportunity, as the station's website says, to give voice to their vision. On Thursday, that meant shows riffing on time travel, Israeli rap, and the lives of some guys named Jason and Gary, among others. KYOU calls it open source radio. Open Source is also the name of Christopher Lydon's new radio show, but the former host of public radio's The Connection says he's trying something different. Chris, welcome to the show.
Brooke, thank you.
Let's start with KYOU. Here's a clip of that.
My own ideal woman is a rocket scientist. This is what I strive for. And not just someone with a firm grasp on the basics of propulsion either, but quite literally a rocket scientist. It's not like being a poet. Any fool can write a poem. I'm looking for someone who knows a little something about solid rocket boosters.
Okay. Chris, what's going on here?
What I hear there is that corporate media has figured it out, as we all have, that in this day and age with the internet, every man, woman, and child can be a broadcaster. So it's worth a try. But theirs sounds to me like a kind of bulletin board, a miscellany. Ours is quite different, actually. We want to say, here's what we think is interesting or important this hour. Help us figure it out. We will ask people to send us MP3 files, as Infinity is going to do. We'll ask them for voicemails. We'll ask them for emails. But we'll ask them in any fashion to join in building the show.
It seems that you are always responsive to your listeners, that you were taking ideas from here, there, and everywhere when you were the host of The Connection.
Yeah, we did.
And so now you've got a program, and the way that you describe it, with the addition of perhaps a more active website, it doesn't seem to be a radical departure.
Well, think about it. For one thing, there's the international aspect. One of my complaints, in a way, about the American discourse at the moment is it's become very bunkered, very isolated. You don't hear West African or Eastern European or Chinese, Indian voices in our public conversation. I'd like to bring them in both as listeners and as talkers, as you can't do in talk radio. You can do it very, very easily in the internet. You can make a global conversation.
But you'll be contacting them through the internet? You'll be asking for their MP3s through the internet? Exactly how will you be getting them on the air?
I think the typical thing will be we will post it on our blog that we're talking about. Say, Jeffrey Sachs has written this big book on the end of poverty. He writes a lot about Kenya. I want to hear Kenyans on Jeff Sachs's remedy for Kenya. So first you write to the Kenyan bloggers and you talk to Kenyan media and you search around for people who have read the book or who care about development and you invite them onto the website and then onto the radio show.
So basically, you're just opening up your phone lines much broader through the internet.
But it's not a multiple of two. It's a multiple of thousands in the sense of voice over internet protocol phone calls are getting cheap. The communication is instant. The world is very, very small in that internet.
Okay, so this is sort of like the public journalism that advocate Dan Gilmore refers to when he says, my readers are smarter than I am. Are your listeners
Amen.
Smarter than
Amen.
You are?
Amen. Absolutely. So are yours, Brooke. I mean, I keep thinking the 5 million readers of the New York Times know more about everything than the 1,000 great editors and reporters who put out the paper. And we now have the mechanism in the internet to feed that wisdom, that energy, that experience back into the content.
Now, the station affiliates who'll be running your show will be paying for it, but you're also making the program available to be reused by a Creative Commons license.
Yes.
What is that?
The principle of Creative Commons licensing is some rights are reserved. You can't go out and take what we're doing and sell it, but you can pass it on and you can reuse it sort of in the manner of remixing music if you give credit to us.
And your affiliates aren't concerned about having that material that they pay for available for free?
I'm not really sure, Brooke. I hope they're not. It's part of the redefinition of who owns the conversation. I don't think the local stations need to feel they own everything they broadcast. We don't feel we own everything we broadcast.
All right. Christopher Lydon, thank you very much.
Brooke Gladstone, thank you.
Christopher Lydon's new public radio show called Open Source debuted last Monday.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.